The debating chamber of the British Parliament was in an uproar of condemnation and invective. "Out! Out!" they howled from the upper galleries, where aristocrats and members of the House of Lords craned forward to get a clear view. "Resign, man, resign!" British politics had never seen anything quite like it. Members of the opposition parties were rolling their order papers into daggers and thrusting them in the direction of the collapsed, already failing, and secretly ailing figure sitting in front of the dispatch box, the Conservative Prime Minister of Great Britain, Neville Chamberlain. But Chamberlain, for many reasons, was reluctant to stand down as leader, not least because of his deep uncertainty about who could possibly succeed him. Britain had been at war for 8 months, and it was going badly. Both politicians and the public were baying not just for a leader, but, as all great times demand, a great leader. One capable of delivering what only great leaders can. Words that can move and sway and convince and galvanize and inspire and even forge in the hearts of the public levels of feeling they do not know they have. From these words would come actions, and depending on the wisdom of these actions, either triumph or bloody defeat. And there was perhaps a more surprising ingredient than any nation in grave crisis might wish to find in its leader. Doubt. The vital ability to doubt his or her own judgments, to possess a mind capable of holding two contrary ideas at the same time and only then to synthesize them. To have a mind not made up, and so remain in conversation with all views. This contrasted with a mind made up, which could remain in conversation with only one person, the self. Britain had little use for an ideologue in these days. What it needed was a 360-degree thinker. As Oliver Cromwell wrote in 1650 to the Church of Scotland, "I beseech you, in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." In these doubtful times, and with the issues faced by the British nation so grave that its very future hung on its next moves, the great question was, where could such a leader be found? "You have sat too long here for any good you have been doing. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." Leo Amery, Member of Parliament for Sparkbrook in Birmingham, resumed his seat to thunderous applause on this, the first night of the now legendary Norway debate on Tuesday, 7th of May 1940. The House had now been sitting for almost 9 hours. It was a warm early summer's evening and darkness had fallen. His words were the knife in fellow Conservative Chamberlain's side. Britain was a country divided, and the government, instead of pulling together, was being torn apart by egos and petty differences which had contributed to catastrophic military failures on both the battlefield and the high seas. The prospect of fascism succeeding and of democracy drawing to a close in Europe was no longer unimaginable. The seeds of the famous debate happening in the chamber that night were sown 5 days earlier, when the news broke that Britain was evacuating her troops from the Norwegian port of Trondheim after coming under heavy Nazi attack for the first time. Leo Amery and members of Lord Salisbury's watching committee, made up of Conservative MPs and Lords with the object of holding the government to account, along with an all-party parliamentary action group with a similar objective, but led by the Liberal MP Clement Davies and including members of the Labour Party, had agreed to force a debate on the blunders made during this first encounter with Nazi troops, and, with this debate, attempt to finally rid themselves of the leader they felt was failing them and the country. Chamberlain had first begun to speak to the House on the conduct of the war at 3:48 p.m. on the 7th of May, the first of 2 days of debate. His words, his attempt at a salvage job, did nothing to strengthen his position or to allay fears that Britain was essentially headed for a wreck. Rather, they confirmed him as being tired and defensive, a man who would only speed the nation towards peril. Looking heartbroken and shriveled, as one commentator later put it, he soldiered on, as far more memorable phrases were hurled back at him by his enemies. He knew these phrases well, for he had fashioned them himself. "Peace in our time," his lofty promise of a year earlier, and "Mr. Bus," his reference to what he had seen as Hitler's lost opportunity to wreak any havoc at all in Europe. Now they exploded like hand grenades at his feet. What muted support Chamberlain received during this speech was described by Labour's Arthur Greenwood as synthetic, for the mood of the House had never been graver.